This week's conversation with Ada Hayden is sponsored by CyberPointers, the only online chapter of the American Needlepoint Guild. Membership is open to all members of the national ANG organization. Meetings are conducted every other month and are run completely online using an email groups program. CyberPointers provides stitching opportunities through meeting programs, ANG correspondence courses, and workshops. Upcoming meetings include Tasselmania by Michelle Roberts, in which members will learn the basic anatomy of a tassel and how to make 24 types of tassels. Also coming up, Surprise by Dawn Donnelly, which is a topsy-turvy cake decorated with fun stitches and bright colors. Registration is also open for the following workshops. Posies by Margaret Bendig. This design is a composition of a variety of stitches to form a ring of flowers with contrast and texture. Also, Mermaid's Tail by Debbie Rowley, which features levels of water painted on a canvas defined with several small stitches with painter's threads. Various overdyed threads and sparkling sequins are used to enhance this design. Also, Persian Chair by Anne Marie Anderson Mays of Beautiful Stitches. This is a miniature chair worked with a variety of stitches with overdyed threads. CyberPointers also participates in correspondence courses through the National ANG. Registration for a tasket by Curdy Briggs is open August 1. Be sure to check out CyberPointers' website at cyberpointers.org for all of their current and future offerings. And now on to our conversation with Ada Hayden. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Eye Candy Needle Art, Ada Hayden. Ada, welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, I'm going to be okay. We're going to learn about painted canvas. We're going to learn about design, Bargello, counted canvas, all of it.
Wonderful. You'll learn all I know anyway.
Okay, well, that's what we're here for. All right, so how does this all get started? I mean, you don't just open the door one day and say, I'm going to paint canvases. So how do you get yourself involved in needlework in general? Is it mom and grandma as a kid, or did it come later?
I think it's because growing up in the mid-70s, crafting was really big then. In school, all the other kids in school did some sort of craft. All of my female relatives did some sort of, remember, like, crewel embroidery was really, really big. That was kind of the beginning of needlepoint, even though I didn't know anybody that did it. But anyway, I spent probably from like elementary school age all the way until my 20s being the world's most frustrated wannabe needleworker. I could not do embroidery to save my life. I couldn't knit. I couldn't crochet. oh my gosh, to have one of the, like, you know, your wash denim chambray shirt with like ladybugs embroidered on it, you know, if you weren't able to do that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Everybody had something like that going on. Yeah,
exactly. And I couldn't do it. I could weave the little pot holders. And I did learn how to sew.
Weaving the pot holders. Oh, for crying out loud. How many of those did we all make?
Oh yeah. A million. Cause I could do that. That didn't, for some reason that wasn't, but I just always wanted to make things. I did start out young drawing, but, where I grew up, there really wasn't any, art programs or anything in school. I did go to, there was like a little art shop that was out of town that I got to go to. And this was, again, this was another big 70s craze, because I've never even heard of it since. There was like reverse glass painting. You know, you take a sheet of glass and you used almost like an ink quill to ink your outlines in, and then you painted it and flipped it over, and then you had had your painting and everything. And then also just, you know, some canvas painting that was, like Bob Ross style.
Oh, okay. So yeah.
I did that. I kind of almost feel like that, because you were copying and everything, I kind of almost feel like that kind of destroyed my creativity for art. You know, rather than just drawing on my own.
Yeah.
Everything. But, you know, I always wanted to make things and always was drawn to textile arts, I guess, because I learned how to sew. And by the time I was a teenager, I didn't hardly own a stitch of clothing that I hadn't made myself. And
in some cases, see, that's something right there. Yeah.
Yeah. At least I could make something that looked like something. So, and my first foray into college was a major in home economics because they actually had a design program for clothes, but, you know, I didn't ultimately end up doing that.
Yeah. Now there's a trip back in time when you can go to college and get a degree in home economics.
I know. I'd like to note for the audience, I'm not a million years old. It almost sounds like I would be.
Yeah.
So yeah, we had that college had a textile lab and everything. It was wild, but I didn't end up in the fashion program, staying in the fashion program. And then once I finally, you know, went back into the school, it was art history.
Yeah. Did you feel through all of that, did you have an art talent? Or did you have a wannabe talent? I mean, were you able to do things artistically? You just couldn't make the needle and thread work, or?
Yeah, always a frustrated artist all the way up until I eventually discovered cross stitch. Thank goodness.
You could do the X's on a grid, huh?
Yes, I think that's what it came down to. I had to find some sort of needle art that was focused on putting your stitches onto a grid, because freeforming it into this day, that doesn't work for me. I will try to do embroidery every few years or so, just thinking like, oh, by now I'm sure I finally maybe developed a touch more. But no, it is a finesse. Silk ribbon embroidery, any kind of embroidery, to me, I think there's a finesse there that you need to have to make it look right. It's not purely technical, because I think in a way cross stitch and needlepoint can be almost purely technical if you want it to be.
Oh yeah, very
but,
much.
But
yeah.
To have that finesse to make it look really good, that is just a something that I still don't think I have.
She'll never get there.
I'd have to work a lot harder at it, I guess, and I tend to just flit off to something else. I'll find something that does work, by golly. So
but that's interesting. So but then give you a grid and you can be obviously very creative.
Yes. Yeah, it's just
you just need that structure of the grid and then you can work it.
Yeah, and it comes out looking like it's supposed to, you know, because
right.
Embroidery certainly didn't, and most things didn't. If I hadn't gotten chicken pox in my early 20s and had to stay home for a while, and I hadn't bought a couple of cross-stitch kits that were just sitting in a box or something, but I got those out and stitched them up, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can do this. This is cool. And of course, they looked horrible. God, I wish I had one even.
Yeah, wish you could? Yeah, here's what I started with. Here's how awful I was. Yes.
Yeah, because even though I was pleased with it, it was still awful by anybody's standards. Because I'm sure I know for some reason, maybe I didn't read the instructions or something, but like the crosses weren't all uniformly crossed or anything.
Right.
Nevertheless, best needlework I'd ever produced.
So one revelation we've taken out of this is we blame eye candy needle art on the chicken pox.
It all kind of started there because I became a rabid cross stitcher. Cross stitch was popular at this time. That would have been early 90s.
Yeah.
I think Cross Stitch and Country Craft magazine was out.
Oh, yeah.
Several cross stitch magazines to which I devoted my life to finding every issue, no matter what it was. And I still have them to this day in my in the storage closet.
Oh, really? So you kept all those?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, we were joking around the other day that the storage closet off my craft room is going to be like, if it wasn't in my private home, it could be my crypt someday. You know, long and narrow, just put the slab in there, put me in, and I'm surrounded by like the fact that I managed to collect every cross stitch magazine published from the beginning, from the first issue to the last, sadly.
Wow.
On all of them. The only one still going is just cross stitch, but but by golly, I still have every issue.
Oh, that's impressive. We moved a year ago and I had a healthy stack of those and I just threw them away. You know, and then of course after that it's like, oh, why did I do that? You know, a fit of I'm not moving this, and pitched them all, and yeah, I wish I'd kept them. You know, whether you need them or not, it's like you know, you just store them away, you have them. But to have every issue, wow, that's an accomplishment.
That's the way I look at it now. And there's nothing where, I mean, even books aren't as bad to move as magazines are. And I probably have almost as many books as well. and considering also, I haven't lived in the same house for longer than 3.5 years since the 90s.
So you're hauling this stuff every time then. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. That is dedication. That's why it is. Like, I mean, as funny as it is, think of it as like, you know, making that thing into a crypt. Why not? I mean, that much money and effort and time and labor put into it.
Yep. Put her right in the middle of it forever.
Absolutely. Cut a little window in the door, a viewing window.
Now we're building quite a mental image here. We better be careful.
Yeah, exactly. People may have figured out by now I may be a little bit weird.
So home economics, and then you go to art history. That's a leap.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I think I've probably always been a frustrated artist. I started as a little kid being able to draw really well. Actually, I don't really remember, but I remember grown-ups being pretty excited about some of the things that I would draw. It's like, oh, that's really good for like a little kid.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I didn't stick with it. And honestly, I think those art, the art craft classes I took, you know, kind of further helped me atrophy. By the time I was actually going into real art classes in college, the kids that were... they would knock out sketches that I would be like, oh my God, I wish I could draw that good. And they're wadding that stuff up and throwing it on the floor. You know, like, I mean, drawing skills, if you don't do it every day, you just, you know, and by the time you get old enough to get self-conscious, oh my gosh, you know, you can draw good as a kid. You're not thinking about it. But once you get old enough to think about it and really start judging your stuff, oh, it's all over. At least that's my experience.
So, oh, no, that's a lot of people experience. As a matter of fact, last week's guest, we talked a lot about that, how you just get the creativity beaten out of you. You get the kid beaten out of you as you go through life. And pretty soon everything you do is, oh, I wonder what people are going to think about this. Is this good enough? And you lose the freedom to just create. Yeah.
And if you're surrounded by people who just sit down and just sketch and they can do it well enough that, like, you know, what's garbage for them is, it's like, oh, I'd frame that.
Yeah, that's intimidating.
That is super intimidating, especially if you're young and in college and everything. So I switched over to art history because I really, really like that too. And you've still got to take art classes, but you know, because they wanted you to know, you know, how the art you're studying was created.
Right.
That kind of gave me cover for being terrible. You know, it's like, oh, I'm an art history major. You know,
I don't actually do it. I study it. Yeah,
exactly. I'm just here for the ambiance and everything.
Yeah. So what did you have a plan for what you were going to do? Cause you know, from a parental experience, what's your kid studying in school? Art history. What's she going to do to make a living? Well, I don't know. So.
No, it gave me an idea about like how we might want to, I mean, for people like me, we might want to restructure higher education in this country. You do your internship first so that you immediately find out that like, I hate working in galleries and museums. But basically, you're, you know, unless you're going to go into academics and write, that's really what you're going to do with art history is work in a gallery, work in a museum. Well, I didn't do that till my fourth year, and I'm like, oh, I hate this.
Oh, this my. So you've been through all of that and discovered you hated it. Oh.
Exactly. I'm like, you should be able to do your internship first, find out, or at least do it halfway through so that you still have a do-over. You know, so
yeah.
I got out with my degree. As they're handing it to me, I'm like, oh, I've made a terrible mistake. and I think I forgot most of what I learned before I'd paid off the loans.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I got this first job, you know, based on the art history degree. And again, it was very art history was 1% of what I did. And the rest was just terrible.
Yeah. Well, what was that first job? Was it a museum?
Yeah, well, it was museum adjacent. I worked for a company that produced the items that were sold in gift shops in museums, and also were sold. We were a big supplier for that museum store that used to be in malls. Again, showing my age and date, everything. But yeah, in order to get it does to have this stuff be sold, you know, kind of tax-free or whatever you call it. It had to be, it had to relate to art somehow. And that was kind of a little bit, that was 1% of my job, is like taking this merchandise and justifying that somehow, yes, this actually really is related to artwork that's in your museum.
So when I go to the latest exhibit at the Field Museum in Chicago and emerge into the inevitable gift shop, then that's your work, yeah, is in there justifying all of the googa.
Yeah, exactly. If it's not a postcard or a tote bag or something with the actual paintings printed on it, if it's just the merchandise and everything for that to be sold, you know, as under a tax-free thing, it was, you know, at least at the time, it had to be like, you had to say, but like, no, this is definitely, you know, related to 18th century art, or this is directly related to Impressionism or Egyptology, whatever it is. So, but again, I got to do very little of that, and the rest was just
4 years of art history got you that, the gift shop.
Yeah, exactly. So no wonder I was so into my hobby at the time, which was cross stitch. And, you know, a couple of months before the Spirit of Cross Stitch Festival would be up, not only had I asked for like the days off so I could go, but that's all I would be thinking about. It's like, oh, I mean, it was better than Christmas for me, going to Spirit of Cross Stitch, which were these, again, for people not born a million years ago, that was a big, like, 5-day touring the country cross stitch festival where you got to take classes, and there'd be this huge merchandise mall and on a convention center floor. Not any little things that are held in like small hotels. But I mean, this was like the one I went to, this was in California, was at the Sacramento Convention Center. And it was 18-20 long convention center floor rows of vendors.
Major. So, well, at that time, I think they were selling cross stitch in gas stations, for crying out loud. You know, it was just everywhere.
It was great. So you go to these shows, I mean, you can see stitched models. You buy all the thread and fabric and books and charts and anything that you could carry. It was fabulous. So that was the highlight of my year, if not my life, was those festivals.
So it smells to me like you're carrying a parallel thing. You're carrying this art history and this job you hate, and then at every spare moment is this growing love for cross stitch and needlework.
Yes. Loved it so much. And when I thought of like what my stash was back then, my stash could have been put in a box, you know, cause only at that time, really still the only thing you needed is to have all of the DMCs, which, yeah, I had, you know, and every chart you could put your hand on, and as much fiddler's cloth and, you know, I think I just got started on linen. And, you know, Mill Hill beads.
Yep, sure.
And then Mill Hill charms and crystals. That was your, you know, your first in embellishments. And I remember talking to people that were into cross stitch way before me. And some of the cross stitch shops were open in people's garages, and you could literally buy everything that you could. You would have the world's best stocked cross stitch shop in your garage for like probably under $10,000 investment.
No.
Probably well under 10,000, I think, is what they were telling me at the time. Because you'd literally have everything, you know? So good times when it was like kind of that small and simple and yet so rewarding.
Right.
Of course, like Spirit of Cross Stitch had really blown out and everything, and people were starting to do counted work and counted canvas. Probably the first counted canvas stuff I bought it at Spirit of Cross Stitch and had absolutely no idea what it was other than like, I love this. I love it. It was Orna Willis. She was the big one. I think there was another couple. But yeah, I bought all those, even though the charts seemed to me at that time horrifically expensive. I think I may have been $10 or $15 a chart. Now, it couldn't have been that much because cross stitch charts were like $5.
Right.
There was paint and canvas at the time, and I'd seen a little bit of that. But those canvases were, oh my gosh, $30.
Yeah.
That's cross stitch charts. I can't do that, and I don't even know what to do with that anyway. What do you do with it?
Yeah.
So,
boy, the fact that you bring up Orna's name, tell, because she's one of my all time favorites. What a talent!
But, absolutely.
You know, what duration that she's had,
yeah,
and still cranking out just beautiful work.
Yeah, absolutely. That was You know, and that was actually kind of just began the journey in a way, because, I mean, you know, finding her stuff at those shows, finding, well, here's another giant, and I don't think that, there are two giants that I discovered at Spirit of Cross Stitch, but unfortunately, I don't think either one of them still designing, would be Sharon Cohen of Nostalgic Needle and Lauren Sauer of Forget-Me-Nots and Stitches. I saw their stuff because there was this legendary shop called Wyndham Needleworks that was at Spirit of Cross Stitch, and they had millions of stitched models, and they had all of Lauren's stuff stitched and all of Sharon's stuff stitched, and seeing those and just like, oh, that's way beyond what I can do, but I've got to have them. I've got so I bought them, and just, you know, I just loved that stuff. I actually probably liked that stuff better than what was in cross stitch at the time, because that was the beginning of folk art in cross stitch. And for some bizarre reason, I mean, your taste can really change. I used to not like folk art, and now I wonder, like, why on earth do I not like folk art? I love it. But at the time, the beginning of folk art in cross stitch, I wasn't really digging all that much.
Right. So. What happened? Because we had kids, so I lost track. But what happened to the you know, cross stitch at every corner thing? Was it economics? How did that just kind of disappear?
Well, crafts always seem to kind of boom and fade and boom and fade. I'm not sure how cross stitch ended up, you know, going out of its boom the way it was. I'm just super grateful that I was there in the boom, you know, both as a consumer. And then I got to participate, in a professional manner. And again, I almost looked back at this. I mean, I know it actually really happened, but I mean, I swear, I think for like years later, I almost just thought that like, maybe I actually just stepped through a wormhole or something at the Spirit of Cross Stitch Festival, because, you know, the last one that I went to, I was, you know, at that, at the job that I hated and everything. And, just thought I was hallucinating when I was leaving the show, and there was like a, you know, a bulletin board out front and everything, and a little table, and there's a stack of flyers, and it was for a, new needlework shop looking for employees and a manager. I pick it up and read it, and I'm like, oh, this can't be true. And even if it is, there's no way. But you know, cause I had asked for a job at a local needlepoint store, during that time, but they're like, and since I didn't know anything about needlepoint, I didn't get it.
Yeah.
And besides that, I'm like, why am I doing that? That's not like, that's a part-time job. That's not anything I can actually do. But you know, I'm like this, if it's full-time, maybe.
So that gives you your transition then. So what was that store?
That was Needle in a Haystack in Alameda, California. And by a miracle, I got that job and I could live on it. And suddenly I'm in needlework heaven. I mean, literally needlework heaven, because Needle in a Haystack was cross stitch and needlepoint, and owned by this lady who, very, very serious, Kathy Ray, very serious needleworker, who was not satisfied with anything less than having everything, which is great.
Oh, no, we know Kathy well. She's done several shows with us, and tremendous shop. I mean, that to this day, a shop where you can get everything that everyone else has, and then everything that no one has.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So don't do anything like halfway. Don't have part of a line. Oh, it was great. But talk about just being thrown in, you know, from like a extremely enthusiastic amateur into going to trade shows. To trade shows, Gary. Oh my gosh. I mean, you just, and honest to God, if I could do it, if I was able to go back in time and choose, like, do you want to be a needlepoint designer or do you want to be a buyer for a big needlework shop? If I could do it the way we did it in the 90s, I would absolutely do a buyer, because that was the best. That was the best. That, and actually meeting the designers and the teachers and everything. I was going to say that was a thing. I went from buying Orna Willis charts, having no idea who she was or what it was, but I knew I loved it, to I think year two or year three at Needle in a Haystack, having her teach at the shop.
Oh.
Going to the airport and picking her up. You know, that, I mean, that, to find yourself like that after, you know, really just kind of figuring that your life had just almost come to a, you know, like, oh my God, what am I going to do with my life? I mean, that's why I was saying it's like, even a couple of years later, I couldn't even believe. I'm like, did this really happen? Or did I fall and hit my head? And
so you get the job with Kathy, you dump the museum job like a bad habit.
Oh, and, my gosh, gave my 2 weeks notice, which they were like, you can't give 2 weeks notice. You can't just quit.
Oh, watch
like,
me.
Well, yeah, exactly. And yes, they still called me 2 weeks later when I didn't show up, even though I'd left my keys there in the mailbox and everything. I'm like, you're going to call? I'm not coming back.
Oh, jeez.
I didn't even care. I mean, you know, talk about burning bridges, but I'm just like, no, this is if this is real. You know, I'm set. And if it's not real, I'm dead and I'm in heaven. So either way.
Yeah. Yeah. You came out of it. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was super hard work because it's not like, I mean, we're dumb enough to think, me and some of the other employees were dumb enough to think that like, oh, once we get set up and everything, we'll be stitching models full time. And that never, ever came close to happening. But still, yeah. It was great to work in something that you love that much.
Right. Well, yeah. To do it at that level where you get to play in just about everything needlework.
Yes.
Wow.
And to have a great budget and everything. Because, you know, I mean, being in a large, well-funded store, you know, Kathy worked in tech, and that was during the tech boom. So we were well-funded enough that, like, by the second or third time I would go to the trade shows. And, again, the trade shows, like the big Spirit of Cross Stitch Festival, except for it's all wholesale. All the designers are there. You get to meet everybody, meet their families. You see every single thing that's going to be on the market. Everything in the world that's available for needlework. Mm-hmm. You're there and you get to see it. It's, as long as you've got the energy to drag through the trade show, all 30 rows, again, convention center floor, you know, talk about getting your 10,000 steps. Oh my gosh, it was fantastic. And I had a big enough budget by the second or third year. You know, some of the designers, when they saw me, they just, even if they were talking to somebody, oh my gosh, there she is, money bags, get over there. She's going to buy one of everything at least.
Yeah.
So, that was great. And back then that was before the internet. So you could go in and shop in a really, organized manner.
Uh-huh.
You know, just go row by row and make sure you see everything. If I had to be a buyer for a shop nowadays, I mean, I feel so bad for the trade shows now are so chaotic. All your customers know what's coming out.
Yeah.
Because I get to buy stuff and you only find out what was new because I bring it to the store and show it to you. But now you go online and these poor shop owners are going to the trade shows with a list.
Right, right.
And God help you, you better try to bring it all back if you can. And if it's like a limited edition, you've got to plan your shopping around getting to the, you know, the logistics of it. I didn't have to deal with any of the logistics. I didn't have to deal with any of that. I could just go and just scour everything and had the time to do it. Now you really don't have the time to hit every shop or.
Well, that's just it. That's a complete 180 because you're going to the thing and coming back and you're revealing to the needlework world.
Yes.
You're the gatekeeper. Yeah.
Yes. And it was just great. Cause I mean, again, there was no, I didn't have to zigzag all over. If I had to do it now where you're having to just, you know, I've got to get to this shop and this shop, and you're sitting there and you're like, I've got to go, I got to see these three designers and which one, they're all three important, but I got to get, which one do I have to get to first? Because I got to get this. Oh, I couldn't do it that way.
Yeah. Cause then you become more of a personal shopper than a selector of what you think is the best stuff or the most saleable stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Especially now with the hotel shows. I mean, when I did do a hotel show back then, it was, again, could be very organized. Get in, get on the elevator, get to the top floor, shop the top floor. Don't mess with waiting 2 hours for the elevator to come back up. Just go to the stairwell, go down to the next floor, go around there. You know, you could do that. Systematic, good, and leave that show knowing that you saw everything. But now, zigzag, up and down, wasting your time waiting for the elevator, rushing, trying to get into a room that has an exclusive. Oh, I wouldn't do it now. It would not be fun the way it was before. The worst was just if it was a cash and carry show, just the last day trying to get out.
Yeah.
So
what did you do at Needle in a Haystack? Obviously, you were a major player in the operation in terms of buying and everything else. Working the sales floor, stitching models.
No, I never got a chance to stitch any models because just too busy with inventory and everything. I was hired to be the manager, but really, I spent most of my time on inventory. Ordering stuff, getting into the computer.
Ooh, there's a tough job. Holy smokes.
Getting it out. Exactly. That was probably the worst part of it. And then, you know, getting it out onto the floor and everything. And, the threads were like, that was like a whole other thing, you know, trying to keep all your threads and stuff. Cause we had everything. The hardest part really probably was the needlepoint at the time, because I didn't know diddly about needlepoint. Then it looked neat, but I didn't understand it and it was too expensive. But with a store discount, it wasn't too expensive and it looked fabulous. So, and I needed to learn it anyway. So,
yep.
So that was great, but that was a big learning curve.
Yeah.
So we were going to needlepoint and cross stitch shows at the time. So,
oh boy. Yeah. So does your designing happen along the way here? Are you dabbling in that? How do you start designing pieces?
I started just by painting canvas, and that was actually that, you know, I honestly can't even tell you like why that would have come about, because I mean, I had access to all the best canvases in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So why I would feel like I need to paint one, I don't know. I suppose it's just like, because you're so spoiled for choice. But I started painting a little bit for fun. And then I ended up painting a big old canvas, that was from, this greeting card that I bought. There used to be these card shops called Papyrus that they had the most beautiful greeting cards, great artwork. They sought out these amazing artists and, just use their artwork on their card. So I had this really great Halloween scene that I just loved. And, again, this is way back in the day that, Amy Bunger, who's probably, the best needlework or needlepoint stitch guide designer alive.
Mm-hmm.
She actually used to, teach, she would go and host, retreats with shops. Before she retired, she got into where she did that same kind of thing, but you came to her. But
yeah.
Back in the 90s, there's a fabulous shop. Because that's the thing, too. I work at one shop, but then I would spend my time at other shops. There was a shop up in Healdsburg, beautiful part of Northern California, called the Regal Rabbit. And they had Amy Bunger out. There was a Victorian B&B right next door to the shop. And they rented the whole thing. So it was ours, like our big needlework dorm.
Mm-hmm.
And you pick out a canvas and you send it, and Amy designs a stitch guide for it, and you go there and you spend 3 days working on it. Again, you think you've just died and gone to heaven. third year in, for some reason, I guess it's just because there were so many good canvases to choose from. I don't know what it was, but I just decided, like, I'm going to paint this greeting card on a canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And send that in for Amy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know. So, yeah, I kind of dabbled around with painting canvas, even though I had no reason to whatsoever, having, you know.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Any canvas I wanted at the time. So.
Yeah. But you wanted to create your own. So off you go.
Yeah. I guess so. I mean, that one I painted like in I was having to actually live with my in-laws at the time. I painted that sitting on a it was a big design. I mean, it's bigger than anything I've ever painted for eye candy. I mean, 18 by 20 or something. I put it on one of those big clipboards and like sat on top of my bed cross-legged and painted it, and miraculously managed to not get paint all over the place.
That was going to be my, okay, how bad was the bedspread when you got done?
Yeah, exactly. Surprisingly, I made more of a mess with nail polish. So, but like, yeah, that's kind of crazy. I still have that thing, and it's like half stitched too. So,
oh, now there's a story right there. You kept the original and you never finished stitching it. Okay.
Yeah, but I never finished stitching hardly anything, so that's nothing special. So I remember being pleased at the time that she didn't know it was a homemade canvas.
Oh.
So I thought that was, I'm like, oh, that's good. Cause I didn't tell her or anything. And, yeah. So,
well, tip of the cap for that, because
yeah, it's kind of halfway decent. Then.
If anybody can pick one out, she should be it. Yep.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So that was good.
So that gets you started. Now, did you ever design cross stitch, or was your design work needlepoint and you just kept going from there?
Oh, I had dabbled around with trying to design cross stitch, but that was never did cross stitch. Tried to do some counted samplers, but those at the time just seemed impossibly difficult to do because of the planning. I mean, I'm just like, it seems simple, but it's really not, because, you know, this band has to relate to that band and then the counts. I mean, how are you going to, you know, compensate? I guess it was probably the first time I'd ever met, you know, compensation. Oh my gosh.
That word, yeah.
This band is great, but there's no way this other band I want to do will work because it can't be compensated to fit. I mean, I just didn't really know enough about the mechanics of stitching like that, or at the time, to get it to work. So I had thought about it, and you know, also that's the thing, cross stitch and counted canvas, you have to, or even counted work on linen, you have to produce. I mean, it has to be completely stitched before you can even think about marketing it. Needlepoint is kind of neat that it's such a shortcut. You get a design on canvas and you're good to go.
Yeah.
Having it stitched is just a bonus.
Yeah. Yeah, because you really don't want to dictate how it should be stitched. You just, you know, that's the creativity at the other end. Yes.
Yes. And that was one of the things that I was really was crazy about with needlepoint. And again, I remember at the time thinking, like, I wish there was some sort of computer place where you could go and see everybody's different needlepoints, even if it was like the same canvas, because nobody stitches it the same way. Like, oh, wouldn't that be great? You could see every iteration of this one design of like how people change it, because, you know, everybody will like change the colors, the threads of you know, no two needlepoint canvases are alike, even when they're stitched in a class usually.
Right. Yeah. So how do you transition away from needle in a haystack to becoming a designer? Is that a gradual thing or?
No, that was a forced life decision, because God knows I would not have left otherwise. And sometimes I even look back and go like, why did I leave? I should have, you know, considering that my husband and I ended up having to live apart for almost 2 years anyway, why on earth didn't I just go ahead and stay? But he worked for Hasbro at the time, and Hasbro did a big thing where they consolidated all of their employees to their headquarters in Rhode Island. So
you're in California and you had to go to Rhode Island.
Yes. Which was like a foreign country, really.
Yeah. No, honestly. Kidding.
Cause I mean, I couldn't even understand the accent, at first with some, with some of the folks. So they have a very, very thick, like the Brooklyn accent, only even more extreme. Cause I had a handyman at the house there in Rhode Island, and he told me something needed to drive for four. It turned out, you know, 4 to 8 hours. And I was thinking he was saying 48. Like, you drive 48 hours. I'm like, what? 48 hours? 4 to 8 hours. They had to really slow it down for me on some things, you know. So, yeah. And just
I've been to Rhode Island. It is really cool there. I love that whole part of the country. But to go from California to the East Coast, wow, what a culture shock.
Yeah, it really was, because I didn't, it really is. I mean, I hadn't been any place where the culture was so much different, you know, but it was neat. I'm like, gosh, it's almost like living in a foreign country, but not really, not enough to be just, you know, where you're really just struggling all the time, you know, and it was very different. And honestly, I really fell in love with it. I spend way more time thinking about Rhode Island now than I do even California. I was lucky. I lived in Napa Valley in California. So that's pretty great too. But man, I just, something about New England and Rhode Island, I just loved it.
Now, people say to me, you know, if you had to travel or live, where would you go? And I always say the Northeast or the Northwest corners of the country, either one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, they've got good weather there. Although I really didn't like the winters. I don't know why, because, I mean, looking back on them now, they're like, they weren't that bad. Just as in go through a Rhode Island winter is go through a Texas ice storm.
Right.
Yep. You know what you're doing in New England if you have some snow and everything, but, you know, have a freeze here like we've had for the past two winters in Texas when you're unprepared for it.
Yeah.
It's a drag.
Yeah.
So,
so you go to Rhode Island. So you had to give up needling a haystack, and now what? Now you gotta find a job at a museum store or.
Yeah, no, that was my gosh, that didn't even actually really cross my mind. But I mean, yeah, I to this day I still can't believe that I actually did it without just dying the way. I mean, because now I just look back and I feel like if I'm who I am now, oddly enough, if the same thing happened, I would probably have just been like, no, we've got to figure out something because I can't leave this. This is too good.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I was young enough to think that like, oh, there'll be plenty of good stuff ahead, you know, but, right. But that being said, it was extremely difficult. I had the worst case. I mean, for one thing, it seemed like right about the time I moved is when all of the shops on the, in that area closed. Oh. There's a great CrossFit shop there called Tapestry of Dreams that again, you know, me being a needlework pioneer, and I didn't even realize that I was a needlework pioneer at the time, but I took one of the very first online classes ever given, and it was by Tapestry of Dreams, located in Rhode Island, Cranston, Rhode Island, on that online service called Genie.
Oh, my word.
And stuff. But yeah, she was, that, you talk about a lady ahead of her time. Yes, but there was a Just Nan class called Star of Light, and I took that online with that shop. So I'm like, well, it's not so bad. I'm moving to Rhode Island. That shop's great. There's some needlework shops and everything. They were closed by the time I finally got moved in out there. Mm. After a nearly 2-year house building nightmare, and you name it.
Wow. So the rug literally gets pulled out from under you.
Yeah. But the worst thing about it, honestly, was a nearly fatal case of FOMO, fear of missing out. And yeah. I'm not even kidding, because when you are on top of things the way I was, and there's still, the internet still wasn't fleshed out as far as like being able to keep up with needlework online the way you can now. It just about killed me, the idea that like, I'm not going to know or see or be able to get
right.
this stuff. You know, so I'm like, how on earth can I keep a foot in the door in the needlework industry? How am I going to be able to do this? There's no shop to work for out here. And
you must have just felt completely abandoned.
Oh, it was horrible. It was horrible. So, yes, a near fatal case of FOMO. If FOMO could kill you, I nearly died from it. Even though I did actually, I flew back a couple of times and went to trade shows with them. With the shop, because at that time they were bringing a whole group of people to trade shows and everything. So that was good. You know, but eventually I just like, no, I just got to figure out a way to be able to legitimately be get my foot back in the door for trade shows again. And if I need to design needlework to do that, I guess I'll just do that.
So that's what, you know, necessity becomes the mother of invention then. So that's what drove you to do it. Okay.
Paint canvas was just a means to be able to, you know, ultimately just be able to get to go back to trade shows again. Cause I'm like, trade shows are where it's at. That's how you're really going to be able to stay on top of what's going on in the needlework world, is you just need to be there. So if I can create a line and somehow get into the trade show, whether it sells or not, I don't care. I'm at the trade show.
Right. Yep.
So,
wow.
But you know, I had to start painting canvases seriously and then make sure that my canvases were commercial quality. And then, you know, finally figure out a way to get into, you know, actually be able to get into the trade show.
You got to go through that whole process from scratch of just establishing yourself and getting into the supply chain. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I started out painting canvases. When I started selling them, I sold them on eBay because that was really the only way I had to go. And I'd ordered a couple of canvases off of eBay that were painted by people. And I still have one that I'll bring it out and show it to people every once in a while, cause they can't believe it when they see it. Even though it cost like, I think $2, it was still kind of a ripoff because it is unstitchable. It's not even on canvas. I've never been able to identify what it's painted on. But I figured, my God, if somebody could sell that on eBay.
A painted canvas for $2 and you got ripped off. Boy, that's bad.
It's bad. It's painted on something, I think some sort of really like a plastic window screening material. I don't. Oh, geez. I mean, it's just, you know, I should bring it to trade shows with me just to like, look, let's figure out what this thing actually is. The thing is, the design was cute, but it's not even stitchable. So I'm like, okay, well, I have already painted canvas that was decent enough that, you know, nobody commented on it in a class of, you know, real high end needle pointers.
Yeah.
You know, the Amy Bunker class. So yeah, I painted, and sold on eBay, and that went really well, except for I'm like, well, I can't really expand from here, without painting 8 to 10 hours a day. And I don't want to do that because very quickly you learn you have no time to design anything new because you're literally just production painting.
Yeah. I think every painted canvas designer has that little moment there where, you know, I can hand paint these things round the clock and not keep up.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then not have a chance to do anything else. Yeah.
Yeah. Never have anything new. And also I didn't want to just sit at a desk 10 hours a day painting the same design over and over and over and over and over again. And also you start worrying about your hands.
Sure. Sure.
isn't that
a necessity though, if you're going to do painted canvas, to at least have gone through that, kind of paid your dues, so that when you go to a service, you know what is good and what isn't?
Yeah, actually, yes. But in my case, I still think to this day, some of the production canvases are better than my original in some ways. Because uh-huh. Uh-huh. The production guys are still better at shading than I am. I mean, my canvases often don't have hardly any shading at all because that's something I still really actually haven't mastered very well. My original will look very choppy, but at least I can send it in for production painting and they will smooth it out and make it look nice because they're like, oh yeah, no, it's not supposed to look like that. So a lot of times they definitely are doing as good, if not better than me. So, and certainly at a much faster clip, because even trying to paint fast, I'm one of the slowest painters out there.
Well, that's tedious. It's tedious work though, isn't it? If you're going to paint it so it can be stitched, I mean, you got to be careful at every change of color and every line.
Yeah.
It always strikes me as a lot of concentrated work to get it done.
You're painting, or at least I paint with these little brushes that are called spotters, and it's called a spotter because it's literally just developed for if you're portrait painting, if you want to put that teeny little dot of white in the eye to make mm-hmm. it lifelike, the best way to do it is with this teeny 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 little brush, you know, like 8-hair brush with a sharp tip, and you dot it in. So it's about the width of a 18 count canvas thread, which is the standard for painting canvases, really.
Yeah.
18 count. And you're painting, yeah, thread by thread. Or at least I do now. I wasn't always what they would call, you know, do stitch painting. Sometimes it would just be more free form and everything. But now everything I do is stitch painted. So,
yeah.
Which means it translates well. If it was going to be done over to cross stitch, it would translate. Cause I mean, you look at the 18 count canvas, it's a grid. So you just, you know, go line thread by thread on the canvas and fill that in on a cross stitch chart.
Yeah. That's one of the cool things that people don't appreciate, is that you can do that and you can get some very nice cross stitch out of that conversion. Yeah. It's a neat thing. Yep.
Yeah, and that's I was really thrilled years ago. I haven't designed anything for cross stitch because again, that's a production thing. I don't have time to stitch a cross stitch model because I don't even have time to stitch, you know, my needlepoint models anymore now. So, but 7, 8, 9 years ago, could it possibly have been that long? I got an email from it was the latest iteration of Cross Stitch and Country Craft magazine at that time. I think at that point, because you know it changed names like 12 times.
Mm-hmm.
The only remnant of it now is this yearly Cross Stitch annual, a hardback book.
Yeah.
That comes out. They emailed me, you know, years ago now, and asked if I had anything I wanted to, you know, if I could contribute anything to the book. And I'm like, you know, I'm needlepoint, right? Well, yeah, but you know, you could design something. Could I send you a painted canvas? Anyway, I've been in that book every year since. I'd have to go into another room to actually see how far it goes back, but I might be closing in on 10 years. I think it's only been 1 year that they haven't picked at least one design of mine from canvas to translate into cross stitch. So I send them the painted canvas, they make a chart, they get a stitcher to stitch it up. It appears in the book, and
that's great.
I'm just thrilled because I got started in cross stitch. I hadn't bought those little cross stitch kits and gotten chicken pox and stitched one of them and got obsessed with cross stitch. And if it hadn't led me from there, this incredibly fortuitous, again, so fortuitous, I almost feel like, they're like, did that really happen? Did I miraculously get a job at a fantastic needlework store at the very time in my life that that's what I really needed to have happen?
Yep.
So anyway, I just love that. I will always love cross stitch. I still buy cross stitch charts. I subscribe to, Just Cross Stitch magazine or any other, if another cross stitch magazine started, I'd get a subscription. I'd go with that because I love it.
Yep.
And I got started there. So it's always really special. So if I had time, I'd learn one of the cross stitch programs that I actually own for my computer to take some of my more stitch painted designs and translate them into cross stitch charts. Because online cross stitch charts are so popular now, it's getting to where you actually don't need the stitch model as much.
Right.
Those modeling programs kind of make it appear like it has been stitched.
Right.
So if I could figure out how to use those, I could open up an eye candy cross stitch line, which I would love to do, but I lack the time or expertise.
Yeah. Downloadable PDF files for cross stitch is really becoming the way to get them.
And that's like, I could, if I had the time, I'd end up bankrupting myself buying them because, again, you're buying them and then you're not taking up any physical space.
Right.
They're cheap as anything.
Yep.
Oh, I can't believe the prices, cause you're just buying a computer file. It's fabulous. And there's incredible designs out there. I'm just like, good God, there's so many talented people.
Yeah. It's really the internet has really opened the gates for, people to be able to get in the game. You don't have the overhead, you don't have a lot of the things, and you can, if you got talent and ability to design, you can do some nice stuff.
That's for sure. I am just blown away at like how many good, especially good cross stitch designers are out there. So
yeah,
just amazing. So, and it seems like kind of cross stitch is having another little renaissance, which is really
I think more than a little. Pandemic has been a big help for that, but I think it was starting to grow before then. Pandemic supercharged it, but I think it's going to carry for a long time. There's just too much.
I hope so.
Yeah, and there's too much accessibility. Young people getting involved because it's affordable. I think it's a great thing, and then we hope they. Obviously stick to it and then grow from there and try other things too. Cause that's paint a canvas. Isn't that far away from, cross stitch. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, especially when you have that wonderful bridge of, you go from cross stitch and then you kind of get into like counted thread work on linen and then, hey, why not some counted thread work on canvas? And then, hey, well, what about one of these painted designs? Cause that's how it was, for me. And again, I'm so glad that I got started in cross stitch first because, being able to, work from a chart, because a lot of people that started at the other end, their biggest horror is charts. My biggest horror still is like embroidery or having to do anything that's random. Whereas them, I can't even do a chart at all. That's another fabulous thing. When I worked at Needle in a Haystack, you know the technique stump work, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And Jay Nicholas.
Yep, sure.
And the world master. I between her and Allison Cole, I don't know who on earth would. you couldn't decide who on earth could be better at that. But we were lucky enough.
That'd be an extremely tough call. Yes.
Yeah, they're both just to die for. But anyway. Our shop didn't actually have Jay Nicholas, but the local EGA had gotten Jay Nicholas to teach a stump work class, which I got to take. Unbelievable. But Jay Nicklaus came to the store, Needle and Haystack there. And, and again, I'm just, you know, I'm like, I'm taking this class, even though I won't be able to do it, 'cause I can't embroider for anything, even at that time. But anyway, she's looking through our cross stitch stuff and looking through our cross stitch charts. And she's just like, you just have to be a genius to follow one of these charts. I just don't know how you do it. I mean, look at this. It's a big old mess. I'm like, you are kidding me. You can make a bee that looks like it would fly off the fabric, you know, using wire and some DMC. And you're thinking that cross stitch from a chart would just be, no, just like that. I mean, we had the exact, the way I felt about embroidery, she felt about those cross stitch charts. And I'm like, oh, at least I, at least I can do that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Wow. Yeah, isn't that amazing? You know, and again, there's a lot of needle pointers that have only done painted canvas. And if you were to try to show them an Orna Willis or something, well, I can't do that. It's a chart. Can't do it. I'm like, well, you follow stitch diagrams when you're doing painted canvas. Right. Yeah, but that's a big stitch diagram. Well, yeah, exactly. It's just big. Do a little, you know. Just put them all together in a, you know, in a grid. In a lot of ways, it's easier than painted canvas because you don't have as many decisions to make.
Right. Yeah, it's done for you. Yep.
Just yeah, painting canvas, you know, you can get really creative, but, you know, at first you're trying to, I remember even asking Amy Bunger, I'm like, well, how do I know if it's a, you know, if I do this on canvas, this thing, she's like, it's a judgment call. I'm like, oh, that's dangerously close to random and in embroidery. you know.
Oh, man. Okay, we got to hear the story about CNN, because we're going to run out of time here. So we got to hear the story about the CNN interview.
Yeah, again, you know, I still look back on those years at Needle and Haystack just wondering, like, God, did that really happen? Was I just in a coma those years? Who knows why, but the news were slow enough that one day at work, I get a call from the local affiliate of like NBC or CBS, you know, one of the biggies out of San Francisco, wanting to come in and interview somebody at our shop that they just picked out of the you know, yellow pages. We need to find a cross-stitch shop because people mass producing.
The young people. Yellow pages is how we used to find businesses and phone numbers. Yes.
Isn't it just insane how much things have changed, you know, because they could have gone online. We didn't have a website. This is early 90s, I think.
Right.
Mid 90s or whatever. Definitely pre-internet. And back then, cross-stitch charts were bootlegged with a thing called a photocopier. Do they still have those? So, yeah, I mean, designers are actually losing money because people would just buy a chart and then, you know, copy it and give it to their friends or sell it or whatever. And it was actually really hurting the cross-stitch industry. But, you know, as much of an industry as it was, and it certainly was much bigger back then, but it was still hard to believe that it could have been a big enough story that, you know, a San Francisco television news journalist would want to cover it. You know, because it wasn't even like it was her hobby or anything, yeah. You know, so I couldn't get over how weird it was. But then I realized, oh, my God, we can't say no, because this is a huge opportunity for the shop.
Sure.
And there's four or five ladies working today. Somebody will do it. No, nobody would do it. No one would do it. So I had to do it, which is a horror for me. It is to this day. Can't bear to make a recording for my own voicemail, you know. I wasn't wearing makeup, hadn't done my hair, wearing the ugliest shirt I owned. I don't know why I'd turn up for work like that anyway, but nevertheless, I didn't have to do the thing interview.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, it always happens like that. You just came out of the garden and then they want to put you on TV. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It was just like that actually was a nightmare. I was like, I can't believe this is happening to me, but what else can I do? So I did the interview. Okay, that's fine. And you know, we got phone calls like locally, we saw you on the news that night, and actually word got out because, you know, everybody was excited. Nobody was excited enough to actually want to actually do the interview, but almost tell everybody about it. So, you know, everybody's talking, calling and like, we saw you on the news last night. Oh my gosh, that's so great and everything. And then for some insane reason, who knows, there's nothing else going on in the world back in those days. CNN picked it up. And was broadcasting it nationally and everything. Then it went CNN International, and we were actually mailing international back then. So, yeah, we would even hear from overseas customers. We saw Ada on CNN. I'm like, oh, my God. Somebody recorded it. We had things called VCRs back then, and you could get blank tapes. People recorded it. We had a little TV with a built-in VCR in the back, and so they were like playing it, you know, in our little waiting area, right. Husband daycare center, you know, in the back and everything. So I was having to, for a couple of weeks, I was having to try to figure out how to do my job in the shop without hearing or seeing that thing.
make it go away.
Exactly. Oh my God. Why did this have to happen? But great publicity.
Yeah.
Great publicity. So, you know, It just goes to show, don't be a slob.
yeah, when you walk out of the house, you never know.
No, you never, ever know. Oh, my gosh. Mm. Still hard to believe. Really, just looking back on the whole thing, hard to believe it actually really happened.
Yeah, oh, that's great. That's great. You know,
I wish I could even, like, I love getting to talk to people who worked in stores back then and everything, because, like, there was a trade show that we went to that got double booked, and Needlepoint got pushed out of the way, and part of the Needlepoint show was held in the parking garage of that. Yeah. Try to find some other, painted canvas people and ask them about the San Diego garage trade show.
Oh my word.
Oh. And you look back on it, it's so insane. Did that really happen? But yes, it did. How a hotel books two conventions at the same time.
Exactly.
And it was TNNA. That was when the National Needlepoint Association was the one who did the trade show. So they weren't a small group, but they were tiny compared to whatever other convention got booked there. And so that's how most of our show ended up down in the parking garage.
In the garage.
I mean, cables taped to the floor, oil stains, dark, cold, even though it was San Diego. God. So,
nuts. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, Ada, this has been a treat. Thanks for doing the show.
Well, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for doing it. And thanks to everyone for listening.